Are you stuck at home in lockdown? Yeah, I know, we all are. Don't worry, we've got you covered, because it's time once again for Live at Night with Pete Ferrero, where whatever happens, happens. Now along with his special guests, here is your host, Pete Ferrero.
Yeah, okay guys, hey, we're live at
night. Tell me what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah, we're gonna jump into this and allow everybody to get in. And Lily, you think everybody is sort of transferred over? Hopefully you're all here.
Hopefully. I hope so. I've posted in all three of the groups, so.
Yeah, okay. And I shared the link, so, you know, hopefully everybody's transferred over. But I am going to tell you guys this. If President Obama wanted to come on Live at Night, or you two, I would pick you two over President Obama. I didn't. I just, you know, am a diehard 90210 fan. Obsessed with it. We literally just moved cross country and I moved 2 minutes away from the Walsh house. So you get the idea of the obsession with the show. But it's an honor to have both of you guys here. I'm going to let you guys introduce yourselves, who everybody is. And you know, we'll kind of go from there. Let's start with Charles Rosen.
Hi, you guys know me as Charles Rosen, but my friends call me Chuck.
Nice.
I was the executive producer in 90210. For the first 144 hours, 6.5 years of TV crammed into 5 seasons. And my takeaway from the show is that the show tried to kill me.
Literally. And Larry.
I'm Larry Mullen. And I came on at the beginning of college and I left at the end of college. And I wrote and produced and executive produced 128 hours.
Wow, amazing. And then we have two diehard fans. I'm going to let Lily introduce herself. And Lily is in charge of the groups, and we're hoping that the groups have found us here. I think it's slowly starting to trickle in, yeah?
Yes, it looks like it. So my name is Lily, and I manage 3 of the Facebook groups, some very active groups with some diehard fans. So I'm honored to be a part of this.
Yeah, awesome. And then Lisa Marie Latino. Are we calling you something different these days?
You call me whatever. I'm really just a fan. I'm not really affiliated with any group, but Peter and I have bonded over our love for the show. Locally here in New Jersey, I have a video production company. We do corporate video, commercial video, and we also produce a local television show called
Hip New Jersey.
So I'm just
happy. What's the name of your show, Lisa?
Hip New Jersey.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Yes. Yeah, it's lifestyle. So the best places to live, work, and play all around the Garden State.
Very cool.
It's so a great I host show. It, I produce it. It's a lot of fun.
So it's
not
an honor.
As like as your show, though.
Yes, right. So it's an honor to have the two of you here. Did you both start and end at the same time?
No.
Oh, no. I did.
They brought me in high school.
We had 2 years of overlap, yeah. Mm-hmm. Larry and I. Fourth and fifth seasons were our seasons.
And Larry, you were longer.
No.
No?
Yeah,
okay.
You went to college, 6 and 7.
I did 128. I don't know. It was hard to say because we did 32 a year those 4 years I was there.
Yeah, Larry did 4 seasons and I did 5 seasons.
7 years. But Chuck brought me in. Chuck
interesting.
Hired Larry.
And he was smart and brave enough to bring me in. Because I was coming off of Renegade, which was a Karate Kick'em Bounty Hunter show.
But what I was looking for specifically between seasons, the high school years, was that to get a little more that we, you know, guy humor into it.
Yes.
And that was, we didn't really, we had that in our second year with a writer named Jonathan Roberts, who was a really nice guy. He did a couple of scripts, and then he went on to write The Lion King. But and he tried to do all the same jokes, the Oweemawet, the Oweemawet. He tried to make our characters singing that on the beach. I said, they don't even know what the song is. So we figured out a way to use it. But then we really didn't have anyone after that because I had no sense of humor back then. I was just treading water. So Larry came up.
Very cool. Fun.
Chuck told me right away that we have to make the show safe to be immature.
Yeah. Well, that was our motto. Helping to keep America immature. And I looking at you three, I think we did a really good job.
Yeah. Well, I always say the show always, I mean, it was so deep and it touched the lives of the people that grew up in that generation, right? I mean, I remember when I was in high school, I had to watch the drunk driving episode. It was like a part of the health curriculum. So, I mean, it became such a part of everything that we did. And then I guess we kind of all grew up with those characters, you know, through that entire time. So there's,
interesting that you bring up that episode, which was called BYOB and was the 10th episode of our first season. And the truth is, if that had happened in season three, we would have had 19 episodes about the crack up of that car. But because at that point, Fox did not want any kind of serialization, we just crammed everything into the crack up of Mondale, which if you look at it again, you realize it was really a fender bender, but with good sound effects.
Totally. I'm curious about how you guys, what is Aaron Spelling like? What is he like in the initial, I mean, he's an icon sort of the, in the television industry. What was he like to work for, both of you? I'm sure he's an eccentric character, you know, but.
You'd have to go upstairs to see him. You'd go up the elevator. The elevator would open up. There'd be a woman named, what was
Renee
her name?
Kamer.
Renee.
Renee Kamer.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Renee Kamer. And you'd sit and wait. Even though
well, that was his experience. That
time,
wasn't my experience.
Wait. And then you went into the room, which was a big, big old office, and there was a pinball machine with his picture on it on the back glass. And he might be eating like a hot dog or something, or peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and you'd sit down. It would be kind of cold in there, I think, as I remember. What do you think, Chuck?
I've thought a lot about this man. And the one thing that he had an amazing ability, which was to live in the present tense and make you feel that this is the moment that matters, and am I glad I found you? And I wish I would have met you years earlier. And that's what he did to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
That he needed something from. And of course he needed things from writer producers like us.
He would call you lover. Oh, lover, come on in.
Hello, buddy. Hi, buddy. Lover, buddy. But you know, Aaron,
stand you in the back. So
I was thinking about Aaron, you know, figured we would talk about him. I could go in a real dark space. I don't really want to. But so because of that, I'll say that the best thing that I learned from Aaron, and it is borne out to be true. And he said it to me very early on, before we had even gone into production, that if you're working with Aaron Spelling, you're making the shows for the audience. You're not making shows for critics. Aaron was not liked by critics. Aaron was the Love Boat and Fantasy Island and Charlie's Angels. And he basically, it was called ABC, but in town, it used to be called Aaron's Broadcasting Company. Mm-hmm. And he really froze out a lot of other companies. So when he was down on his luck, he didn't have that many friends. Once he was off of ABC, he had one friend, Barry Diller, the same one we were talking about before we got live here, and he gave him a commitment to do the new Charlie's Angels, and the new Charlie's Angels didn't work out. It just wasn't good. And out of that, they gave him a script commitment, because Barry Diller went to Beverly Hills High School, and he's fascinated by Beverly Hills High School, and they were very lucky to meet Darren Star, who created the TV show.
When you guys would sit to produce the show and pitch ideas, is it a group of you that are pitching ideas? Is Aaron in that process, or is it Darren Star that's in that process? What does that process look like in terms of people pitching ideas in the room?
Well, Darren created the show. I was the showrunner. We worked together for 2 years, the first 2 years of the series. And then he spun off Melrose. He and Aaron spun off Melrose. And we did our season three, our senior year. And I would say that was my favorite year.
Yeah.
When I graduated. But anyway, I liked all the odd years. 1, 3, and 5 were my favorites. But you're asking about how it works. Well, no, in fact, I have all my notes here from the time. You know, you work up stories and I kind of arbitrate. And the story behind 90210 then in the beginning was we did that. The staff did that. We had a nice slate of shows and no one bothered to tell us that they didn't want a serialized television show. And that's kind of what, you know, 30-something was doing and Hill Street was doing. I mean, everybody was doing ensemble serialized, and they just hired an ensemble without a minority in the cast.
Right.
We were salmon swimming upstream for 5 years with our critics on that point.
Right.
But, you know, so, but, you know, it pretty much goes through a channel. Larry and I together, we worked with a woman named Jessica Klein, who's was in partnership with her husband, Steve Wasserman. They wrote a spec, they did it all. She wrote, and Steve wrote a spec script in the first season, the one about the tennis player who wants to kill his father.
Yes.
Then they became story editors, and then they became producers, writer-producers. And Jessica, a very smart woman, and can talk faster than anyone I've ever met. And she would sit down in front of Aaron Spelling and just go, or the network, and just crank her up, tell them what we want to do, Jessica. And she was really good at it. So once we got to that point, we were pretty good. They were much more careful with us during high school, particularly the first two seasons. Once we solidified, then they backed off. Then they trusted us, and I think enjoyed our success more.
Yeah,
I mean my experience was we would go up there with usually the producer and writers of the episode, and Aaron would invariably say, "What's Donna doing this week?" And we'd start there, and then we'd basically work through the story, and he would give some insightful stuff because he really knew what he wanted. And then we'd pretty much be, you know, by ourselves. I mean, when we were doing that many episodes, there wasn't a lot of time. We got like one set of notes from Aaron and one set of notes from the network, and that was pretty much it. Maybe one other person in the spelling company.
And they were, you know, I can show you, you know, the covers of our scripts. You know, they were really happy with our scripts. I mean, We did loggerheads sometimes over issues in high school, issues pertaining to teenage sexuality. But, you know, we didn't have too many. I think I threw out one script the whole time, just threw it out and said, we're eating this. It didn't work. I can't even remember what season we did that. There was only one page one rewrite. What I'm most proud of as a producer, I did 144 hours. And only one episode that was written during the our first Christmas break in the first season. Every time an episode started, the first day of prep, we had our script had already been delivered, had notes. You could work off it. We worked one of my mentors in the business is a friend of Larry's and mine, a peer of ours named Josh Brand. And Josh, when I did Northern Exposure with him, I did St. Elsewhere with him. I did a lot of different things. And he just said, production is too hard. Don't make scripts your problem.
Yeah.
And so we really tried to work it out, you know, it just seemed to fall into place. The characters were well delineated and we all were, had things to say and points of view. And Spelling was very supportive during the whole time, really, until he wasn't, but he mostly was.
Hey, Chuck, not to get off, obviously, the 90210 beat, but you brought up Northern Exposure. Did you work with David Chase?
David took my job when I went to the zip code.
There you go. Nice. Okay. Was there ever, I've heard you talk a little bit about this, but how difficult was Fox to deal with, the network? Were there ideas that you guys pitched and they said, no, you're not doing that? Or did they pretty much go along with everything that you guys wanted to do?
Well, again, let's separate high school to college, because it was really two different entities, two different institutions. They were really a broadcast service, just kind of finding their way in the beginning. And here's this show with, you know, them wanting teenage sexuality. But when you have a young guy doing teenage sexuality, it's a dirty joke. It's Married with Children. Right. And when it's geared to women, you have, you know, dramaturgy. And that's what Aaron did. And certainly our series changed dramatically in the first season on two episodes. One, Isn't It Romantic, the AIDS episode, which would not have been made had Aaron Spelling not stood up and said, I kind of want that one in front of the network, in front of Peter Chernin, who was running it then, to say, you know, this one intrigues me. Aaron at that time was in production or pre-production on a, and the band played on, which is like a definitive movie about AIDS that HBO did, Emmy winning movie, probably his signature achievement in that regard. So he cared a lot about that. And then of course, when Brenda loses her virginity to Dylan, and the, you know, the floor dropped out on that one. They weren't prepared. Fox had a really a kind of a third tier station group. And you know, put a lot of pressure, and advertisers, I guess, whoever was doing it with Rupert were putting on pressure. But, you know, the network had already changed. You know, it was our current department. They didn't know what they were doing, and they were, some of the guys were trying really hard. I'm thinking of Dan McDermott, particularly Larry. But, you know, they brought in Sandy Grushow, and who later became the president of the Fox Broadcasting Company and Fox and everything. And Sandy... we righted it on their ship.
We should say that we were producing 32 hours a year, so there wasn't a lot of time for them to complain about anything or to shoot things down. There was just a machine that was running.
Right.
To do, when you figure out just the actual math of to do 32 hours, and you have to have pre-production, production, and post-production, and deliver.
Especially when especially when Larry and I were doing the show. I used to always get this vision of like a Charlie Chaplin starting Modern Times on our first day of prep, of just, you know, going down on the machine, and then it just goes wild out of control. Larry's absolutely right. Really, the two first seasons, we were only doing 22, they had time to get in. Actually, that's not true. We did 22 the first season, but after that we did 28.
Right.
The second season, because of the summer episodes.
Now, who pops that idea off? We're going to do episodes over the summer. Brilliant, brilliant. I mean, I think that's where we all kind of got hooked on the show because of everything.
That was Barry Diller.
Barry Diller.
Yeah.
He, you know, summer episodes were a staple of television when Larry and I were kids, you know, back in the 60s. There'd always be the, you know, the Smothers Brothers would go off and Glenn Campbell would have his show. That's how Glenn Campbell became it. Or Robert Klein, the comedian, yes, had a summer show once.
The other thing was you could have original episodes against reruns, and you could make some traction in the ratings.
Right. It just hadn't been done in a while when he, although, what am I saying? Northern Exposure, we had done it the year before, and we had a cult hit status, and Barry, I'm sure, looked at that and jumped on it, too, because they had already determined really early on that that our original audience only wanted first run shows, and they weren't, you know, there was no obsession going on. They weren't going to go back to see something they already knew. So that profit that they were really making on the shows were a little bit neutralized by that. So they really encouraged us to do first run and only, and that was tough stuff. And then we had to do double ups.
Yeah, I'm going to let Lily jump in here because I know there's a lot of fans with very specific questions as you guys are ready for that. So give me the first from fans, and we'll start there. What do you got?
So one of the questions that's not so in-depth is, out of the entire group, who pulled the most pranks?
Okay.
Larry, do you have an idea for that?
I would think Jason, or probably Luke, actually. I don't know. I mean, again, the writers and producers, we were on one side of the hill and the actors were on the other. So we didn't spend, unless we were there to watch production, we didn't really spend a lot of time with them.
We had our production meetings in at our warehouses in Van Nuys, part of the valley. and Mr. Spelling's office was on the it was on Wilshire Boulevard in the, what's called the Miracle Mile, right by across from the Brea Tar Pits. Our post-production was in sound was at in Hollywood, but at a different location than where we did our picture. We did casting in mostly in the valley. And so basically my job was to drive around in circles all day talking on my phone, which was a new thing at that point. I called myself the itinerant producer, not the executive producer, itinerant.
So, okay.
Ogden Nash kind of joke.
All right, wait, before you go to the next fan question, I'm going to put you both in the hot seat. Should, who should Dylan have been with? Brenda or Kelly? Who did
right,
you?
I'll let you go first.
I would say Brenda.
Brenda was our favorite character to write for, but I would say Kelly.
Really?
I'm with Charles on this, yes.
No.
Very I direct you to go to the pool scene on the roof at the Bellage Hotel.
Yes.
And that's really all, for a young man, that's really all you need to see.
You know, Brenda and Dylan, though, they were so iconic. And to me, my favorite 90210 couple was Kelly and Brandon. I thought their chemistry.
I feel that way too.
Thank you, Larry.
Larry gets to talk about that because you were there in the sixth and seventh year, right?
What?
Larry.
I mean, you were there when they were. Did you the one with the marriage?
Yeah. They were a couple when I was doing stuff with them for a good part of it until she got into drugs. But they were a good couple. I always thought that was, you know, an end game. That was, you know, David was going to end up with Donna, Luke was going to end up with Brenda, and Jason was going to end up with, Brandon was going to end up with Kelly. I always felt that was going to satisfy the most fans. You know, that's what we you know, because it was before the internet, so we just kind of had a sense of what fans wanted from the couple of fan mails we would get.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Kelly and Brandon's chemistry between the actors, it was off the charts from season one. Like as a 6-7 year old, I felt that. So I always rooted for them to get together. So at the end of season four, I was so happy.
And let's go to the end of season four while we're here. This is, you know, it's similar to when probably Suzanne Summers walks out on Three's Company, right? I mean, Shannon didn't necessarily walk out. But this obviously became topsy-turvy, right? I guess that's the easiest way of putting it. How did it become known to you? I'm sure you guys had arcs thinking about future seasons down the lines and whatnot. How did it become known to you that, okay, we have a problem here with Shannon and she may not be coming back for the next season? I'll go to Charles.
Talking about the second episode of the first year? That's a joke. an agreement was reached. She reached an agreement with Spelling Entertainment. And we, you know, when I think about her relative to the end of the second, for the fourth season, by that point, her leaving was a fourth plot story. We had Don and David cheating at the school carnival. We had Brandon and Kelly in Washington, D.C. in the hotel room. And we had Dylan losing all his money.
Andrew was having a baby.
Right.
So by that point, we had really removed her from the core of action. And when you go back and look at the fourth season, you know, it there was some tension there, and it's evidenced by who the actor she was playing off of. She was playing off that guy, was David Gale, a Spelling guy. Not my cast, Sire. But good for the character it was. They didn't have much going on, but she was there. Then she was with the animal rights people, right?
Right.
She was an informant over there. So she was, but boy, oh boy, once we got into the theater plot, and her and Jenny and that Melissa.
Laura Kingman was the character.
Yes.
And the actress, oh, she's terrific. What's her name, Chuck?
Oh, it is such an unfair thing because she is really terrific.
She's fantastic in the season, too. Yeah.
Tracy Mittendorf.
Forgive me, Tracy, because she was also a pleasure to work with. Yeah. And, you know, we were doing Tennessee Williams.
That was amazing to be able to do that. That was so much fun.
Yeah. No. And we did got a lot of mileage. One of my favorite scenes with Brenda in the fourth season or episodes, I don't know if you wrote that one, Larry, I'm sure we had our hands in it one way or the other, was the one where she's in theater and it's experimental theater and the director tells her she's got to take off all her clothes.
Yeah, I think
I remember that.
I created the Roy Randolph character. I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun. That was, you know, I remember when we had to deal with the Tennessee Williams estate and talk them into it. It wasn't that hard. They actually thought it was pretty cool. I mean, it was, you know, it was a real coup, I thought, you know.
Yeah. I love the Roy Randolph character. Did you really create that? What happens? How did you create Roy Randolph?
Well, I was writing that episode, so I got to create the character. But, you know, we just kind of, you know, created some kind of a pompous director from England, you know, kind of a Brit. And
British guys, I have friends who are British. You know, British guys really just trade up on off their accent a lot.
Right.
Exactly.
I lived with one of them with Berkeley. And we both of our, anybody in this co-ed house realized, this guy's an idiot, but he talks well. But he's an idiot. Right. So, you know, I mean, we gave a lot of points to the accent.
But, sure. But it was fun. We had, you know, we had the auditions and it was, you know, everyone was going for the part. It was a good plot line.
Yeah.
And plus you had Laura Kingman and I think she tries to hang herself, right?
On the stage. I think she does. I think she does try to kill herself.
If you are a guest star or you kiss Brandon, the covenant you make with Leno is you have to go crazy. I'm sorry, but it kind of was the easiest way, you know?
And, speaking
sometimes. Except with Emily.
I was going to bring Emily up. Yeah, that's what I was going
to
bring up.
They made us do that to Christy. I wouldn't have done it. And she knows it. So Larry has a different relationship with her than I do. But I would never have made her be so whack job.
Yeah.
I would have figured out a different way. Somebody with psychological problems, but figured out a different way to get her out of there.
When did it become
my druthers, you know, but I didn't.
Like Emily becomes Brandon's sort of what muse, I guess, is that, you know, he's always into Emily. He chases Emily. He goes after Emily again years down the line. Why Emily
They were living together. And here's the other thing too. I don't even know if you know this.
The real people, right? I got you.
Living together.
Yes. Right, yeah.
So it was easy. We could get to her. You know, she'd answer the phone if I called. But
one script, we could save money on the script.
Yeah, but also but the thing is that she basically, you know, going back to the early research on the show. You know, research is a whole division of a network television show. Really hard to appreciate it sometimes. It can be overbearing. Some of the research was really, really awful on this television show starting out. But I think it was the second group of research tested something that I just used after like episode 6 for the rest of the time, which was make references to past episodes and past people. The audience likes to see them come back. Or if they saw the show, know about it. And so we have that in research to do. So the term of art for that in television is recurring characters.
Mm-hmm.
And we had loads of recurring characters.
You did do it quite a bit. Like even Ray left and came back for a little something. Everybody would come back for a little something. Was that difficult at times? Did you ever pitch something like, oh, I think we should... Maybe we should try to get Brenda to come back, or we should try to get so-and-so to come back. Or was there anything that was like, no, we can't do that?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, all those things. Yeah, I mean, sometimes it was schedule a problem, but, you know, it was sometimes just wasn't going to fly. They weren't going to make a deal, or some people got too expensive, or, you know, for whatever reason, they just hit the end of the trail.
Yeah.
Did you try to get Brenda?
A lot of good actors started on the show or certainly built their career a little bit on the show. That's certainly something.
Sure.
Did you try and get Brenda back?
Did what?
Did you try and get Brenda back?
Well, try. We say, hey, how about, can we have Brenda back? And they go, no. Okay. That's it. I think because Chuck, I mean, the second, you know, Chuck and I, well, the first year I started was the end of it. She left and she went to study, you know, acting, which I have to take credit for that, which is kind of sad, but it was kind of, that was the joke because we sent her to learn acting. But no, but she was a terrific actress. So life.
Of course. Of course.
Someone with a photographic memory and just the natural instincts of a master, really. She was excellent. But that was the joke. And then the next year we had someone else. They weren't really asking the fifth year, but the sixth year we did say, hey, wouldn't it be great? Like Dylan, we'd keep her alive. We certainly would stock in occasionally phone calls that we heard from Dylan or, you know,
and, well, you know, let me ask you, Lily,
all the way to graduation when I was there, the end of college graduation. Wouldn't it be great to have Brenda at the college graduation?
Right. Well, sometimes it always was odd to me, like that, you know, there would be like this party or a reunion, a high school reunion or of some sort, right? At some point in our line, it's like, how did Brenda not go? Or a wedding or something like that. You know, how did these characters just say, nah, I'm going to skip my sister's, my brother's wedding, you know?
We would try to cover it. You know, we'd try to explain it and, you know, and she'd take some shit. People would talk shit about her for a couple of lines because she's really not, you know, ignoring them. But, you know, but Brandon would always smooth it over. You know, he was loyal to his sister.
Yeah, very cool.
I'm wondering, and I've never even thought about this before, but, you know, here's this conversation, you know, in year six, I mean, I really had to get out by year five. I was exhausted. I had done it. But if, and I was a consultant, but I wasn't really in the mix as much. I think if Larry was running the show, we would have definitely been in that moment. We would have been in the
channel.
I probably would have as a consultant. But one of the things is that, you know, if we would have really thought out a through line to get Dylan and Brenda together at the end of it, and Dylan goes off the show with her, would that have been what you guys would have liked, Lily and Lisa, looking 20/20 hindsight? Or did you love the Rebecca Gayhart plot, and that's it?
It's hard to let go of that. You know, that is a very special episode with Tony. You know, I don't think anything with Brenda could top that. That was Luke Perry in that moment.
When
Luke Perry, you know, is on the road and whatnot in the rain, I mean, it's one of the most beautiful scenes in 90210's history.
Got trouble the cat with him.
I can tell you, the majority of the groups, you know, yes, that scene, that final scene, a wedding and a funeral, that was an amazing episode. And there are a lot of people that love Tony's character. I would say that the majority of the group would rather have had Luke just leave and be off with Brenda in London and not even come back for seasons 9 and 10.
Yeah.
And end up with Kelly at the end.
No doubt.
Yeah.
We had nothing to do with that.
Yeah. No,
you guys are long gone. It's their problem.
One of my questions here, what are your feelings about seasons 9 and 10 and how do you feel about the finale of Abe and Donna's wedding and, you know, have none of the Walshes there?
Yeah.
Well, for me, my feeling will be expressed this way. I watched the episode, A Wedding and a Funeral. And I watched an episode where Steve Young, the San Francisco 49er quarterback, did a guest star because the director was, well, I was pretty close to the director then, and he wanted me definitely to see it. And I watched I was on the set the last day with my wife and my three kids on the, when David and Donna got married, that scene. We went back for that day. Oddly enough, I was doing a pilot then for Fox, a low budget pilot, and we were using the warehouses that 90210 was filmed to do the pilot. You know, good synchronicity.
Yeah.
But so I really have no feelings about the show after I left. I was lucky to have the experience, and I carried it around like an anchor after that for.
I kind of really looked at it quickly and was very disappointed because the whole idea, and which Chuck imbued in me, was that we were writing ordinary kids living extraordinary lives. And that's what made it relatable.
Right.
When they graduated college, they were extraordinary kids living ordinary lives. They messed up the thesis because then they couldn't get the businesses going. They should have been doing great things. Brandon Walsh missed the point of the show.
Right.
Brandon Walsh was the former president of California University. He didn't need to struggle like that. Steve had music business. He would have kept the music thing alive.
Right.
There was so much to
like,
do.
And he's opened a cockamamie newspaper. Like, that's so stupid. It was like.
And the thing is, the guy who came in.
It was all wrong.
The guy who came in season eight.
Yeah.
The guy who came in season eight was not a fan of the show at all and basically got hired because he said, I'm going to change the show completely. And by that point.
Yeah. No, don't.
By that point, listen, if you would have, in a normal television environment, if you had a hit show, and you'd had as many episodes as we did in the can, you would have been able to rally the cast and the people and the writers and say, look, we should go on out on top.
Yeah.
And I kind of said that to Aaron. He did not counter, was to say, when I said I have to leave, he didn't counter as, well, just take it up to year seven. Let's just get him out of college together.
Well, that made sense.
But
okay. Lily, do you have another fan question?
I do.
Okay.
And of course, it involves the triangle. So the Brenda, Dylan, Kelly love triangle. Kind of one question piggybacking off another. Is it true that Luke asked to work with the blonde? And if that is true, why? Was the Dylan and Kelly relationship intended to be long-term? And is it true that Dylan and Brenda were supposed to get back together at some point, like after Jack McKay's funeral or at some point during season four?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Can't you hear me
everything
knocking?
Everything that you asked, the answer is yes. Except the long-term intentions, because we were just trying to get through five episodes at a time. So long-term, by that point, I don't know. But certainly... the conversation, the exact language, we would have put the two of them back. The Wassermans, who I mentioned, Steve and Jessica, were big, big fans of that relationship and really wanted it. And that was a time where Shannon just was kind of making it seem that she didn't really want to be there. So those two things were in conflict.
Was the haircut, was Shannon cutting her hair during the production? Did that have anything to do with her leaving or no?
No, I don't. You mean back in the first episode? You mean
when we? No, I think she's talking about off screen. In the off screen, she changed her hairstyle or something like that, and it got some slack from what? Right? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, there's a rumor that part of the reason she cut her
that
hair.
That did happen. The first time I spent any time with Shannon, it was with you don't know this, Larry, with Tony Shepard. And Shannon at some Beverly Hills, like Jose Hebert or somebody like that, you know, someone really at the top of the fashion game at the time. Yeah. And to make sure that her hair was the same as the pilot. So if you look at the first episode that, the green room, the one with the shoplifting, you'll see that her edges on the hair is a little much more clipped than the gentle roll. But she wanted to, we wanted Shannon to be the girl next door, and she wanted, in some ways, to be the riot girl next door.
Yeah.
God bless her, because she brought that to it, and it's what made the character.
Okay, someone keeps asking on YouTube, so I'm gonna ask it. Was there ever a consideration for Brandon and Andrea to be a couple?
Yeah,
We felt that we kept that out longer, that there would remain interest. Just the series just went a different way.
Yeah.
I think that, it was always considered, but it just never.
What about
it? It didn't make much sense. At some point, it didn't make any more sense. Yeah.
Well, it's that unrequited love.
Right.
I mean, don't we all have that? You know, and that's what we were using there to differentiate it. They also were peers. Interesting. We weren't going to, no Me Too movement here. They were in the workplace together and they were okay with each other.
So. Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about, Kathleen Robertson, Claire Arnold. I know that she's gone on to do some really awesome things in the last few years, but what was she like to work with for both of you?
Well, she was fun, I thought. I mean, you know, we liked the character. Chip Johannesson, I think, was the first one to help create the character and created the character. And we all got to, you know, just have this smart alecky, you know, daughter, you know, entitled girl who was, you know, too sexually curious, a little bit younger than the other people, a little bit dangerous. And she just jumped to it. She just lit up the screen, I thought.
You know. Yeah, she was a one-er. She's the perfect example. That was going to be a one and off. Mm-hmm. And he took her to the prom, and that was going to be it.
Well, yeah, she handcuffed herself to his bed.
and we knew we had the chancellor's daughter, you know, the wild daughter of the chancellor. And she just, great. You know, to have a, one of the things, certainly then, I think much less now, but yeah. Certainly then with all the inhibitions around, to have a really pretty woman like her, very attractive, and she exuded that in the room, be able to do comedy was, even if sometimes it was the same delivery, she really had timing. And we all like looking at her. I think eventually she's Canadian, and I don't think she was a spelling gal. All said and
done. Well, and you know, she had great relationship with Steve on the show, and also with Brian. You know, they were both of them were kind of a little bit different, but they were fun, both of them.
Oh, the relationships, yeah. And
Steve, which was such an interesting one, because you know he was not her intellectual equal.
Right. what did you got, Lily? You got something else?
Yes, I do. So we were talking about Andrea and Brandon becoming a couple, but a couple of people have also asked about Andrea and Steve. Was there ever any consideration into having something going on between Andrea and Steve?
No, not really. We had Andrea with the teachers. We had her looking.
I like that.
She was really mature. She didn't really have time. And these were the friends. I mean, you know, in the culture of the late 90s, would they have had a hookup for sure?
Right. Yeah.
But we weren't there when we started the show. And, you know, we really weren't trying to have the bad girls and not have sex be perceived as bad, because here was Brenda having sex. Did that make her a bad girl? The girl who was Laura Layton. I mean, Laura Layton was pitched to me to be an escort. I said, what do we need an escort for? You know, and I'm talking about this going second to third season.
Sydney from Melrose Place.
And she went to Melrose instead, exactly. Because they wanted to work with Laura. I mean, she was fun, I guess. I never really met her. I don't want that kind of character. Mm-hmm. And the other one, though, 2020 hindsight, and it was really Mr. Spelling who didn't want to do this. Drew Barrymore had gotten out of rehab. And the Barrymore Spelling was royalty. Barrymore's a royalty. And we met and, you know, to see if she'd want to do the show. And it was more in a social kind of gathering. I remember being around her and Jason and seeing that she and Jason were friends. I think it might have been at our first Golden Globes, actually. And then she wanted to then do it. And for whatever reason, he didn't want. And we know ultimately, I can't say this because I'm not in his mind, but, you know, it was Tori's show.
Yeah.
Just remember, that was his relationship to the show. One of the good things that Aaron and I had in common is we both were strong believers in nepotism.
Right.
And I don't think I could have got through the first season at all without doing it with my wife, Karen. So,
right.
Second season as well. Afterward, then it slided out. And then I got Larry.
There you go. And you got the Rolling Stones, right? We talked about that in another episode. Yeah. I wanted to ask you about the Jamie Walter, the Ray Prout character. How did he come about? What was he like to work with? And was it always kind of known that there was going to be this push down the stairs and all that stuff? Because it seemed to like alter his music career too, where people were, I've heard, right, that that this character did this on television. What did you guys think of Jamie?
Well, let me start just talk about how he came to the show, and then I'm going to hand it to Larry, and then I'll comment at that point. But he was somebody. Jamie Walters had a big hit, "Touched by an Angel," and it was on the Heights.
Talk to an angel.
That was it.
That's right. How do you talk?
How do you talk to an angel?
Right.
And you know, that earnest, cute guy played it well, and show didn't have any traction, but the song was a hit, and he had a very good manager at the time, and they came in a per spelling, and were you in that conversation?
Larry? Yeah, Steve Tyrell. Yeah.
Tyrell, yeah, Steve Tyrell, who became a really prominent in pianist and interpretist of classic, you know, a pop, but they came in and we, by getting Jamie, you know, again, we're doing 32 hours. I'm just looking for material. What can I do? How many episodes can I get? How many plot lines can come out of this notion? Oh, you want to be a guy who can play? Oh, we've got an empty warehouse. Why don't we have the Peach Pit have music in the night and call it the Peach Pit After Dark?
Love it. Wish it was a real thing. I'd be there tonight.
and that's so he was the chicken and it was the egg. I mean, he came first. And then it was like, we could do this. And one of the cool things was allowed us to get good groups to come in, groups we probably wouldn't have got. And A. And B, it allowed us to have more shooting on our sets.
Yeah.
And you know, going on location is fun, but it's a hassle and it costs more money. Producer and me.
You know, the Jamie character, we did want, the thing is, we wanted to bring in a blue-collar character. That was the whole idea, that Donna would have this relationship with the blue-collar character. Once we met Jamie, you know, like Chuck said, they came in, he had been in a spelling show that failed, and they kind of pitched him to us. And we said, yeah, we love the song, and the kid was good. And then we just could really... we just took it where it went. I mean, no one had an idea that he was going to push Donna down the stairs at that point.
Right.
We started, you know, don't forget, part of the fun of Jamie's character was that no one else liked him. You know, of the characters in the show, they, you know, they didn't really approve of him. It was always kind of strained. He was resentful. And he had a chip on his shoulder. He worked in the pumpkin patch and there's a lot, and his mother was kind of like alcoholic trailer trash.
Right. Oh, it's a brilliant character too. His
and
mother
remember,
his
this,
mother
this
is a, brilliant. Yeah.
And his mother could only afford one tea.
What?
His mother could only afford
exactly.
one tea.
I can take credit for that character. I did create the character with that one line. His mother could only afford one tea. Let's prove it with one tea. Which we continue to talk about today, years later. Which is good. I've used it again, actually, in something else.
That's awesome.
The concept. But he was a darling guy, and when we you know, Chuck had Chip and I write the 2-hour finale in Palm Springs, you know, it was going to be pretty interesting because Ray was going to have to go there where there's this big fraternity sorority thing, which is totally the wrong place, and it's just not going to be feeling right. And then, you know, thinking about it, we were looking for something big. You know, again, it's a season ender. You got to make people come back. There's no binging here. You just need to sustain for 3 months until they come back or whatever long it was. So, yeah, but then we did have the idea that the next year we would put him in rehab, you know, because he himself was an abused guy. And we thought it was really going to be a plot that had.
And it would have been it was a really good idea. I remember Jessica having kind of a vision about that. And again, if I hadn't left the show, it was a great thing to start dealing with violence against women and young women. It was in the wheelhouse of what we had done, and it was too bad. And then, but because of it, there was fallout, right, Larry? I mean,
well, what happened we had already, you know, we had jumped into the new season. I remember it was Steve Wasserman, our other dear colleague, and you know, we were ahead in the storyline. And when we had to go up to pitch the storylines to Mr. Spelling. This is after Chuck now is gone. And before we could even pitch the storyline, he said, I'm having a problem. We're getting some mail that people think that Donna is stupid. We go, what do you mean? And we go, well, they think she shouldn't be with this guy. But we just signed the guy for like 32 episodes.
Right.
And literally, I don't remember the exact figure, but it was certainly $1 million. Okay.
Right.
And he said,
I don't think so. I don't think they would have paid that much for him. That's just me. I don't think they would have done that much.
They, you know, it was like a fait accompli. I mean, we were banking. Like, we just spent like, you know, a month getting storylines together. We're going to have to throw it all out now.
Yeah.
We have to tell them. So I actually had to tell them. It was a terrible, terrible time. Maybe you could have wanted it, but we couldn't. You know, we were too new. We didn't have the equity with the old man, maybe. But that went by the wayside. He just said, no, we have to get rid of him. That was it. And they just.
What you had to do with Aaron.
You know, it was bad, but he got paid off.
What you had to do with Aaron is Aaron. This is an odd thing to say, but not really, living in the world of chaos with our president. Mr. thrived on stress. Stress was all around him. He lived at stress. He made his life much more stressful than it ever needed to be. And he took a lot of things personally. Too much personally. But one of the things that you could always do if you had it there is, in terms of the template, was to basically say, yes, but we're going to do this. So just in terms of the fourth season, one of my favorite moments was when we pitched the beginning of the storyline of Suzanne coming with the daughter and saying, I'm yeah. wife and all that. And eventually they'll steal all his money. She'd be working coots to steal his money. And Spelling said, no, they'll know from the moment she walks in. And I said, I promise you, when we get to the end, nobody will be thinking about it. And I think
you did. It was brilliant. Yeah.
I was. Also, Steve and Jessica, it's something that Larry said. And you know, I've talked to Jess about it. Steve, I don't remember ever talking about it. But this was the, you know, he would act in stress like this. And the question, and they would, and he'd go, oh my God, we got to jump. And they would go, oh my God, how high? And I was on my vacations and they would call me and I go, just tell him to relax. I'll be there. And you know, you could calm him down. I mean, he drank more than he should have. And at nights he would get hysterical. And you had to know, when is he coming with these conclusions and this. Now, I didn't get mail. Aaron took that away from me after the first season, unfortunately. So I never got that. I didn't, but a couple of pieces of mail. The one thing we did back off on, and Larry knows this, is we would have loved Deshaun to be with Donna.
I was just going to ask you about that. Yeah. That was a beautiful little thing. You started to plant seeds for that.
Well, yeah, we had, there was a kiss involved. There was a kiss that was going to happen, which never happened. It was, I think it was in the episode where David has a blind pianist. And there's a
yes.
blind story in there.
It's the one, you know what it is? That's the one where they had the calendar.
Mm-hmm.
When they shot the calendar and all the boys dressed up in the calendar
yes.
thing. Yeah, yeah, so that yeah. was going on. They yes, that's where, and Cres Williams, name of the actor, he was in that. See that episode.
Right.
Again, another example of a recurring character.
What stopped the kiss?
His name was Aaron Spelling. He was my boss.
No, he just said that's not something that we're doing on this show.
Went upstairs and pitched it, and we went downstairs without the kiss, baby.
Well, remember, Larry's going up and down. My office was always on the same floor. I only at the very end did I go down. I never walked up a stair from there. We were the same floor. Now, why were we in this corporate building? Why were we there? Well, because when the show started, the show got picked up. We were in Warner Hollywood, which is where Spelling's office was. And they're moving into this brand new space because he doesn't have as much production. He doesn't need it. And it's a Thursday at about 4 o'clock. And everybody's leaving and the studio's not going to be opened on Friday. And I call the head of facilities, who I had just met, who had just put me into this office 2 weeks earlier. And I said, where are our offices going to be in the new building? Pause. Let me call you back. So we had no office. We did the show for 2.5 weeks without offices. And we're back at a post-production of Twin Peaks in a mm-hmm. back rooms. That did not play well with the writing staff.
No, I bet not.
Who do they blame?
Yeah.
Their first time executive producer. So, you know, that really added to the stress.
Sure.
And basically they had to give me an office that was fit for Obama. It was a huge office, our corporate office. Silly, yeah. Actually, how big it was. But you know, I enjoyed it.
You know, one thing I remember about that, Jessica would always say, our job is to make sure that Mr. Spelling has a good night's sleep.
Well, the night, the day
that wasn't her job. That was Stoli's job. She shouldn't know that.
Well, the day you pitched the Deshaun kiss, it probably wasn't a good night for him.
Yeah. No, well, what he actually said, Larry, I remember this really clearly because you know I only look Jewish. You know, I have a lot of looking at racial issues was something I grew up with and had a lot of simpatico for the complexity of those situations. And Spelling, a man from Texas of a different generation, took his cue from his longtime black cook in the house. And she was also a Southern woman. So what she could see in that area was Mr. Spelling's influencer.
Mm-hmm.
Not Martin Luther King, the cook.
Right. Lily, what else you got?
Well, just to kind of add to the topic that we were just discussing, a lot of us feel that Brandon and Charisse, the Popcorn King's daughter, had incredible chemistry. Was there ever any discussion about getting them together, having Vivica come back on, or?
When that came to, again, remember, we start with the premise that 90210 was in a hole because we didn't have the kind of diversity that you were starting to see on television already by then. And so the idea of, you know, like, how do you do a variation of like the old movie, Guess Who's Coming to Get Dinner? It's Guess Who's Moving Next Door. And we put together that really wonderful cast. I mean, it wasn't just Vivica Fox, who's very, you know, sexy and hot and just starting out. You know, it was Tina Lifford, as you'll see her on so many shows, the mother. The guy was, oh, forgive me, he's such a good actor. Who played Shaft?
What? Who?
Who was Shaft. The guy who played the actor?
Hold on.
Yeah. Let me see if I can. Okay, we're going to Google it. We're going to have the Google machine.
Because that's who was the father.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Bad, I can't remember. Richard Roundtree?
Right.
I think that was it.
Yeah.
So anyway, it was a really accomplished, and the young boy, the photographer, Eugene Bird, has also had a nice career since being a child actor. And I was really gung-ho about it. I had found a collaborator to work with me that episode who was the in vogue, fortunately, named Judy Ann Mason. She's passed a long time ago, but she had real talent. We got along really well and thought this could be a spinoff. And it was the lowest rated show we did that season. That's the viewing audience of the Fox Broadcasting Company. No way to have that conversation after. Just as for contemporary fans here, you know, when the reboot started to go down after the first 2 weeks, you had no chance for that to survive. Rating thing starts to plummet. It still is, you know, it's pretty hard to make the case. And we had no case to make.
Go ahead, Lisa. Yeah.
No, I wanted to ask you both about the reboot this past summer. What were your thoughts about the meta take that they had on it?
We enjoyed the show.
Well, you know, when they won me over early on, but when they did the Ray, they brought Jamie Walters back and redeemed him. I mean, how could you not love that? I mean, the possibilities of working in and out of the show and what they were trying to do with them, it was really going to be interesting and good, and I really applaud them for it. And
I really enjoyed the
pleasure, really.
Yeah, I really enjoyed seeing Shannon.
Yeah,
how she did the part of it. And I thought, my hat goes off. I do some stuff every once in a while. I put my head in at CBS, and I know how hard it is, their viewpoint of 90210. They own the copyright. And it was tough for them to get it off the ground. And I think they both acted great. And I really was sad that they didn't get another turn. But the fact of the matter is, I believe the show was probably too expensive for the room.
Yeah. And if we don't ask this question, and you guys have absolutely no control over this, but the music changes that they've made on the show, you know, now that it's playing again, it destroys the integrity of the show and what you guys attempted to make.
Okay.
Will we ever see this music get straightened out with 90210?
Okay. Darren, if you're listening, if you're still on this, you know how much this means to me. Larry, will you be quiet? Because he doesn't necessarily agree with me on this campaign. But I feel it is, it's an embarrassment to me. And it is a, we worked really hard on those music choices. We really worked hard on this. And there is no place right now to that CBS has said, well, why don't we just take a couple of the episodes and put them over here and restore the music and make it up and see if there's a market for it.
Right.
If you're not going to do that, then how about you take a couple of episodes and you figure out a way that you can put them on the Museum of Broadcasting and people can look at them and see the way we intended the show to be, at least for a couple of them. So one of the things is I've been dealing with that for a couple of years, and I'm actually very close to, in fact, I was hoping that this conversation would give me some energy to do this, and I think it will, with your help.
Yeah.
Because what I want to do is make the case to CBS that, and I've been making the case to CBS, I used to call it Restore the Music. Now I call it Save Television.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're not the only show that got our music stripped. My other television show that I ran, Dawson's Creek, music stripped.
Mm-hmm.
Happy Days, music stripped.
Melrose.
That was the, that had all the great music. And Universal had...
Miami Vice.
Well, even the Wonder Years, you know, even the Wonder Years.
Again,
yeah, well, I'm not sure
when we did music deals then, they were only for 5 years. There was not in perpetuity. It was just,
right.
We were penalized by it, and the record companies see this as a real area of profit for them, and they don't really care. And the network CBS, and Mr. Spelling was pretty much in his dotage by that point. I'm sorry if that's a harsh word to say, but he's pretty there. And they just went forward and stripped the shows. And yeah. I didn't know. I was not part of the organization. The hard part was the guy who stripped the show is the person who made all the music with me in those first 5 years and produced all of our record albums. So it was really odd that he would pervert. You
know, Chuck, they did try to make the deals because I had some songs I wrote on the show and they came to us and made a deal. So
yeah, well, no, I understand.
It was basically record. Warner Brothers Universal. And Warner Brothers and Universal would not roll over on these new deals.
Right. What songs did you write on the show?
Let me finish this, please. So what I'm going to do in the last, I'm in the last leg of getting back to them and making my final appeal. And also, listen, I'm an owner of the show. And so I've seen the value of the show go down because the music's not there.
Mm-hmm. So
I'm not real happy about that either in terms of, because this show got passed on from subgeneration to subgeneration. Every 5 years, a new group of teenagers would find the show. It could have kept going on. Not happening now. I can assure you that. Now, the broadcast industry's changed. I get that, too. But be that as it may, I feel that CBS has an obligation. Our show made a lot of money for them. You guys are the fan group. You guys are the ones that are being denied. And if they say no to me, which is what I fully expect will happen again, you need to start to really help me.
Yeah, there needs to be a signed this petition or something.
Start a major campaign to shame them. Because some television company has to step up and do this.
Yeah.
And CBS, who's never been a leader, despite if they were in news back when Walter Cronkite, they had some great shows. They haven't been a leader in broadcasting for years. All they do, are they the leader in ratings? And every show is there. If you look at them, all they do is kill people. They kill people on Hawaii 5-0. They'll kill people in CIS. It's just a bunch of killing. That's all they do. Thank you, Les Moonves.
Larry, what are the songs that you wrote for the show?
Oh, I'm trying to think. Well, certainly in season 7, there's a music video that David and Donna are producing in the first episode, Don't Be.
Right.
I wrote that. And then I wrote another song that David has a singer that he's working with. In season 7, he's like a young pianist he's working with, and I wrote that song. And then I wrote another song for the variety show, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police song or something.
That's pretty cool.
I remember, you know, it was kind of nice. They paid out about $20,000, you know?
Yeah.
for the song. So obviously some people took the deal, but other people didn't. The big record companies didn't do it. They just should have.
Yeah. What do you got, Lily? You got something else?
Well, just speaking of the music, I just triggered a question here, okay. A question that gets asked often in the group, and we can't find it anywhere. Was there a name for that song that played while Dylan and Brenda were dancing in Baja in a Mexican standoff? You know, the scene where they're dancing and there's a Mexican band. We've tried Googling lyrics. We just can't seem to find a name for that song. We've had quite a few people ask about it.
Don't know it.
Well, gee, I have no idea. That was actually filmed in Malibu.
Mexico, Malibu.
Larry got to go to Baja, California and film, but I didn't. He got to go.
Kenny Miller may know. You know, that's who would know.
Yeah. Well, we can find out that question for you. Who gets credit for the amazing scene in which I still when the dad walks and they finally get this cabana. They're gonna buy the cabana. They're renting the cabana for the summer, and you know he walks out and he sees Brenda kissing Dylan. In the showers, and it's a horrific, like it's the worst kind of kiss for him to see. Who came up with that? It's a brilliant time. Every time I watch the show and I get there, I'm nervous for him. I'm nervous for James Eckhouse, Jim Walsh.
And that scene was hotter than the pool scene, might I add?
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But we did do that. I know that specific. Well, we arced that out for him to come back. Obviously, I mean, let's talk. So all hell breaks loose, and Darren is, because I wouldn't do it. Even you know, I was arrogant. We had really fought. Our television show was censored, right? So we lost 30 seconds cut out of the last episode of the first season. When she tells them I'm late, they promoted it all week and then they cut it. So I wasn't in a really good, and didn't tell us. So wow. I wasn't in a really good mood as it came to the show. But Darren, you know, God bless him, he said, this is what they got to do and we're going to do it. He saved his fights for later. He was still young at that point. And he wrote that episode where Brenda's go, I can't do this anymore. We broke up and this. And from that moment, starting from the exact moment after that, it was, how are we going to get them back together? This was that entire monologue. Everything talked about that was for us to appease a group of advertisers who were threatening the Fox Broadcasting Company.
Wow. And
we couldn't even deal with anything sexual in the second season at all, or boyfriend and girlfriend. It was just, you know, not much kissing between, and spelling like kissing, very little kissing in the second season in this, not very much conversation. And then finally, Karen and I just went, oh, fuck it. You know, Magic Johnson has got AIDS, and the Anita Hill trial I'm looking at on television, and William Kennedy Smith is on a rape trial in Florida. What are we protecting the kids from? And out of that came, everything you want to know about sex, you know. Mm-hmm. Everybody's doing it, what we called it. And that was, everybody's story had to do with sex. And after that, the battles kind of stopped.
It's interesting, too, because I feel like some of the stuff that happened with Dylan with the drug addiction, you guys did go hard. I mean, so whatever you guys were, whatever kind of pushback you were getting from the network at times, I mean, like, he was doing drugs and even Kelly was addicted to cocaine at one point. So why?
Well, once we went to college, we had to have more adult themes. I mean, they let us have more adult themes because Fox, it was an 8 o'clock show, but because Fox only programmed 2 hours, they considered broadcast standards considered a 9 o'clock show. So they had a little edge on the other stuff we would be competing with at 8 o'clock. We were a little bit more risque than they were.
Yeah.
And right from the start, that first episode, The Green Room, we established that, you know, Dylan is an AA.
Yeah. Yeah. So what about the Kelly cocaine? Kelly's had some crazy things. The cocaine thing obviously is outrageous, but even her getting hooked on in the cult, you know.
That was so great.
Created Finley.
The cult stuff with Professor Finley in the wheelchair and stuff.
who created Finley?
The villain was a
well, Chip did again.
Alan Toy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chip, Larry's referenced him, Chip Johannesson, and he's my, he's gone on to be an Emmy winner. He's the producer and showrunner of Homeland. He did 24. He's very bright. Person and really the work he did on 90210, I tapped into his young side, I think, but very funny. Didn't he was in Lampoon. He really a very talented individual. And he looked at the world, just kind of in a different way, would come up with this. So he came up with the cult. He basically, the language of the cult, and a professor that would be
negators. They were negators.
Negators, yeah.
All the language, yeah. I mean, it was all right from the start.
Fucking brilliant, yeah.
And it was a lot of fun.
It was perfect. When I was a freshman in University of Wisconsin, a really popular teacher was kicked off campus. So I remembered that and kind of used that, and this is where it came out.
Yeah.
It just was a basis of that.
And what about her cocaine addiction? Who comes up with that?
I was done. I wasn't there. I wouldn't have liked it. Larry Johnson.
That was you.
We were going to have a bad boyfriend. So we had that guy Colin come, the New York guy, and he was an artist. And, the cocaine thing just kept rolling. And,
yeah. We were
kind of drawn from our more nefarious experiences ourselves. And it was, it ran its course pretty good. And then we had her in rehab and we had the crazy other girl, Paige Moss.
Tara.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah.
Tara. We kind of stole the single white female plot a little bit.
Yes.
Famously.
Oh, that's a good one.
And that was kind of fun. She was really a crazy character, actress, this Paige Moss. I don't know whatever happened to her. But she was
She's fantastic in it. Yeah. Lily, you got any more? We're getting to the end here. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, maybe two more.
Okay.
Who were your favorite guest stars, and what are your feelings about the 2008 CW reboot 90210?
Let's do guest stars.
I got one. Monica Schnorr, I think that was her name. Chuck, she played the transvestite. I'm now on Instagram friends with her. She was a gorgeous model. Like a man playing a woman. I mean, but she was good. So I liked her, Monica Schnarrer. Her name
was. Brilliant stuff. Yeah.
My favorite, and forgive me, I'm old and I forget, AJ, who one of my favorites. She played in My So-Called Life.
Yeah, she was good. She plays John Sears goes after her.
John Sears' girlfriend.
Right, yeah.
And this is a
good guy.
Now, this one, there were so many I could talk about, but this one comes to mind because, here we were in the fourth year, but even from, we knew after our second year that Zwick Herskowitz, people did 30-something, the pedigree of the entertainment business, had a high school show, and it was gonna be like the non-90210 show. And I remember Jessica and Steve, and we're just, oh my God, they're gonna, how can we compete with them? But they're very happy with themselves. And so they refused to take any of the network notes from ABC. They said, we're ABC Circle. We don't have to take your notes. We're did 30 something. And the show, and they were at an impasse. So this very talented young actress that they had hired, who couldn't work and was there, was like, "Would you like to come and do a guest star for us?" And she was great. She was a real star.
AJ Lang, maybe.
AJ Langer. That's it. AJ Langer. Yes. Yeah. And she, I looked her up recently, and she like married royalty, or something like that. She was really a wonderful person. And I remember I joined her a lot.
The People Under the Stairs. I liked her in that movie.
Mm.
But I also really like Cres Williams, played the basketball character we were talking about. I loved, they just were in arcs. The ones you have. I love Mrs. Denise Dowd. usually? Is she a guest star? She's more of a recurring character. Yeah. You met a more like a one-off, I think, right?
Yeah. So every time we have people in different industries on this late at night show, we ask them this question. What was the one thing during 90210 when you were working on the show that you would say to yourself, again with this shit, what was the one biggest pet peeve maybe that you would have working on production of, whether maybe be something with Aaron or whatever that answer possibly could be for either one of you? Again,
well, mine's really easy. I can get it right out of the way. And I used to have this battle with Sandy Grushow, who came out of promotion, that oftentimes we would have these cliffhangers and different things, and they would do the promo to get people excited, and they give away our effing endings. It drove me crazy. And I, why do you have this? And once in a while, I'd get them to change. That was the hard, biggest pet peeve. Probably.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really true. That was really bad. Pet peeve. It's hard to figure out. I mean, the only peeve I would have is, because it was so difficult to do the 32 a year, I used to just hate waiting for the notes. We just had this dead time and just used to drive me crazy. And, we didn't really have like phones to play with or anything.
Then. Right.
So we smoked basically. Whatever we could get our hands on. That's all we did. But that was kind of it. It was a very enjoyable experience.
Awesome.
Hey, Pete, I have a couple quick questions that I've got.
I'm gonna let you pop those in, but I gotta indulge my Rolling Stones brain and ask Harry, because I did a whole episode on this on the Stones episode. But for you, what was that experience like?
Oh, that was Chuck and I together. I mean, once we realized we could do that, it was just so exciting. I got to take to write the script on it. And plus, we were going to shoot, tie them in. I mean, and Chuck was kind enough to let me write a part in for myself, which I did.
Brilliant. Yes. The roadie, right? Yeah. And,
security. Trouble with SAG for it, too. Like, I guess every time I would appear in one of my shows, they throw the book at me. it was theoretically unfair, but it was a great thrill because, I had been a roadie. That was the thing. I had been a roadie for Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And when I was doing the rehearsal, I saw the Stones roadie, and in 1969, their Stones head roadie was my boss, Larry Waterman. And I saw him, I said, Larry, it's Larry Mullen from the Stone Story. He goes, hey, what band are you with? I said, no, I'm producer on the show here. And I was the roadie at the time, so he didn't believe me.
Right. It was an amazing experience though, right?
Oh yeah.
I would just like to say, if I wouldn't have talked about the promos at the, that Fox did, I also would have talked about SAG. I didn't get along with them. And ironically, one of the cast members of 90210, who I'm still close with, Gabrielle Carteris, is the president of SAG. Yeah.
She went on to be class president.
One
yes.
thing about the Stones episode, which was just a misfire, which was the network. No matter what we could do, they played the thing the night before Thanksgiving, Wednesday night, when all our audience was driving home from college.
Right.
It was a low rated
episode. Yeah.
Like, I don't know if they were trying to hide this Rolling Stones, because the Rolling Stones.
I don't know. I don't think so, Larry. I think it was the last night of November sweeps.
Yeah, it was.
And that's why they needed because the one thing I want you guys to realize, though, because we've talked about double ups and you see that, hear that, and it's like abstract to you. Realize that the Rolling Stone, the reason that Larry wrote that episode and we did a lot together on it, but why it's his and not mine together, we were also doing the fire episode at the exact same time.
The
two biggest episodes we had.
It was, I can't even imagine for actors what that is like.
For actors, I remember the assistant director sitting on the floor of the UPM, the unit production manager's office, at from like 9 o'clock. To like 1:30 in the morning, as Paul and I are drinking scotch, wondering if we're going to get this thing together at all, trading strips. Well, if you put the actor in this one, I can then move this.
It was a puzzle. He was called the double up czar.
It was the craziest thing, because you had two completely different units shooting at the same time, and you would ferry. We had extra drivers, and you ferry the actors.
But those two particular episodes. Those two particular episodes. have a lot of moving parts in them. You know what I mean? The Fire is a whole one thing. And then you're shooting the Rolling Stones in concert where you have to get people, you know, the actors in the stage, the stadium and whatnot. That must have been the craziest double up.
We had good logistics, and that's what we ended up talking about, I know. But,
yes,
you know, the one actor now that I remember was the hardest to place in that was Ian.
Mm-hmm.
His just didn't work out. He'd be in too many scenes, different ones. So you make adjustments, you make it work, you know.
You know, yeah. We should mention Paul Wagner, who really was our genius producer, our line producer, who kept everything together and you know, kept the – and he was the actor's – you know, the father confessor, basically. He made it our job easy because we didn't have to worry about that side of the hill.
Absolutely. It was his problems. He dealt with the spelling company in production with the man named E. Duke Vincent, and he dealt with the actors. We did casting in his office, and he died much too young.
E. Duke Vincent, did they get the bookie Duke? Is that where they're getting that name from?
That's where we got the name.
Yeah, I love it. All right, Lisa, what do you got? You got a couple more.
Yeah, I do. On Facebook, people are dying to have these answers.
Here go ahead.
Did you get any criticism about the Scott Scanlon episode?
Good question.
No, we won awards.
How does that even come to play? Like, we need to kill off this character.
Well, we were the lowest license fee in television. We spent less money than any other show on television for the first two seasons. And they were always looking at ways to, you know, cut back and save money. And it was suggested that, you know, the development that we had, you know, especially because really I'll just be, you know, when Ryan Austin Green in that spring dance episode, and we saw him dance, and we went, wait a second, this guy can do a lot more. He's not just the comic relief.
Right.
And so, you know, how are we going to develop this character? And right when we were thinking about that, there was a murder at the Disneyland Hotel on prom night. And I thought, oh, that is the saddest thing to have a young person die on a special occasion like that. And that got me, and my issue now, among others, is gun violence. And so it was a way to do that. And I have said, you know, on record, it's not a big thing, but it was a big thing at the time. It was the only episode that Miss Aaron Spelling and Sandy Grushow, the network and the studio, asked me not to do, that I ended up doing. Mm-hmm. I didn't do one they asked me not to do. And we never even got that far down the line. But this one was, you know, and I just said, we have to do it. You know, I just kept insisting and going back to this and the violence, and we'll do it. And I wasn't suicide. It was a gun accident.
Yeah.
And that was when anyone called it suicide, they were wrong. And we never called it suicide, never played it suicide. And he was not, maybe.
It was an accident.
So anyway.
Yeah.
Gun episode. I love that one. One of my favorites.
I think it's a fantastic episode.
Directed by Dan Attias, Larry.
Mm-hmm. What do you got?
One more. Yeah. So early on, did you intend for Jack McKay to be in the witness protection program, or did those later producers just decide that during season 10?
It's a great question.
So I he was always involved with the FBI. He always was an informant. The irony of all of that is we filmed it in such a way that allowed him to come back in that way.
Yes.
You never saw him blow up. We filmed it that way, because that's what I wanted to do. And Luke Perry said it was the most bullshit soap opera thing you could possibly do to bring him back. But by that point, he's working on the 10th season of Beverly Hills 90210, so he knows a lot about bullshit, serious soap opera shit. So there you go. Yeah. Loved Luke. But it was the soul of the show, of course. It was the soul.
Let's end on Luke. I'm going to give you guys both an opportunity to share maybe a Luke story or a memory that each of you have that touched you in some way, or just, you know, just enjoyed. Let's end on Luke.
You want to start, Larry?
you know, again, I, because the, you know, the writers were on one side of the hill, I didn't spend a lot of time with them, but I, you know, I can just say that I just enjoyed his sense of humor and stuff. And also as a writer, you know, we had script readings, and he, you know, after the script reading, he would come over and he was challenging, but he always knew how to do it. And then he had good ideas. And so he just was a good professional. But watching him on the set with the other actors, he was, you know, he loved to, you know, cut it up a bit, especially with the women.
Sure. Well, he, you know, you made the reference, so much I could say about Luke, but you made the reference before, we talked about the blonde and him coming in and saying the blonde, wanting to work with the blonde. Well, what he did say that in that meeting, because what we had, I allowed the cast to tell me what they thought of their year, how we did with the characters and what would they like to see. And everybody got to do that starting from the first year, anybody wanted to. And Luke came in and we had done the spinoff for Melrose. We had had Jenny over there and we had, you know, let one of their characters be introduced in our show and that to accommodate Aaron and Darren Star. And Luke was furious about that. And he said, you're going to take it down. You're going to be a soap. We're going to do this. We got to scramble. He always did that. And when we got then to the fifth season, and it was, I want to be losing everything, and I'm going to play it hard, and we're going to do drugs. Yeah. You know, the truth is that both in the third year and the fifth year, the caliber of his work, if he was on a different show, he would have been a serious nominee for an Emmy. But yeah, it was on our show, so we got a Golden Globe nomination, a couple of them. But he did seriously good work when he played a down-and-out character. And he wrote me on the cast. Elvin Kester wrote me a script, and he said, you know, we butted heads and did this. And the last thing he said, and I'd do it all over again with you anytime.
That's really nice. Well, guys, I think we did a really good job. I mean, we've been here for a couple of hours now talking about 90210. And but by the way, we probably can go like 10 more hours. We will not tonight. Anyway, I would love to have you guys both back here. But I've been all about gratitude these days. And listen, there's a lot of people that are watching this right now. And to the both of you, you guys were a part of creating something that truly gave us all something very deep in our lives. And even if it's just a joke or saying one of the lines that maybe one of you guys came up with, it's a part of our being. And you both should be, we're very thankful and gracious to the both of you for the work that you did on this show. And I think that I probably am speaking for everybody who's watching this right now. And thank you guys for doing this, Lily and Lisa Marie. I appreciate all the extra questions and whatnot. And next time, maybe we'll try to get Facebook working. We'll see. But thanks again, guys, for doing this. All right.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Later, guys.
Stay safe, everybody. Stay safe.
Thank you. Bye-bye.